8. Brains made of brains. Top-down computers and bottom-up brains. A bacterium is equipped to sense gradients that matter to it, to discriminate a few vital differences, to make itself at home in the unfamiliar surroundings of its tiny umwelt, capturing the energy and materials it needs to thrive and reproduce. Plants and other sessile organisms organize the cells that compose them into larger armies of slaves with particular tasks to perform, feeding and protecting them in return for their services as monitors, expediters, growth controllers, and so forth, without needing to invest in the sort of distal perception systems that permit an organism to be mobile, without bumping into all the wrong things. Swift control is the key competence of mobile organisms, so nervous systems, with a headquarters, are obligatory. Note that while plants have elaborate information transmission systems controlling their responses to variations in the world, these are distributed systems, not centralized around a hub of any kind. Brains are control centers for dealing swiftly and appropriately with the opportunities and risks, the affordances, of a mobile life. As we have noted, brains are designed by natural selection to have, or reliably develop, equipment that can extract the semantic information needed for this control task. An insect is typically born with a mature set of competences, its expectations already installed by the history of encounters of its ancestors. An oviparous fish has no time for swimming lessons in its youth and has no parents around to teach it. It has to have a swimming instinct built in. A newborn wildebeest must almost literally hit the ground running with scant opportunity to explore the world and learn of its marvels. If she can't keep up with the herd, she's dead meat. Other mammals and birds can afford to be altricial, in contrast to precocial. They are designed to be fed and protected by parents during a prolonged infancy, picking up semantic information that doesn't have to come through their genes and doesn't have to be learned by unsheltered trial and error in the dangerous world. Even if they are purely Skinnerian creatures, they get to try out a relatively unrisky selection of learning environments chosen for safety, competently but without much comprehension, by their parents. One way or another, brains develop competences, including the meta-competences needed to acquire and hone further competences. Before turning to some of the specialized ways brains are designed to extract semantic information, it is time to address the issue of how dramatically brains differ from the computers that have flooded our world. Control tasks formerly performed by human brains have recently been usurped by computers, which have taken charge of many things, from elevators to airplanes to oil refineries. Turing's theoretical idea, made operational by John von Neumann's implementation, the serial stored program computer, has multiplied exponentially in the last 60 years and now occupies every environment on Earth, and has sent thousands, perhaps millions of descendants into space, the most traveled brain children in history. The brilliant idealizations of Shannon, Turing, von Neumann, McCullough, and Pitts have led to such an explosion in information handling competence that today it is commonly supposed not only that brains are just organic digital computers of one sort or another, but that also silicon-based computers will soon embody artificial intelligence that will surpass human brains in all the achievements of creative skill. To echo Beverly's outraged charge that Darwin thought that absolute ignorance could do the same trick. I take it that Beverly stands refuted. The absolute ignorance of evolution by natural selection is indeed capable of creating not just daisies and fish, but also human beings, who in turn have the competence to build cities and theories and poems and airplanes and computers, which in turn could, in principle, achieve artificial intelligences with even higher levels of creative skill than their human creators. But the kind of artificial intelligence that was originally developed to be executed by Turing's and von Neumann's wonderful machines, GOFAI, is not likely to be the right species of software for this momentous task. and the underlying hardware, the von Neumann machine and its billions of descendants, may not prove to be the best platform. Turing, as we noted in Chapter 4, was the epitome of a top-down intelligent designer, and the computer that he invented was an ideal tool for implementing top-down designs of all kinds. The elevator control system project was a top-down exercise in problem-solving. The programmers were given the specs in advance. They were thus able to use their intelligence to anticipate difficulties that might arise, going through the work cycles of the elevator in their imaginations, looking out for affordances, positive and negative. When should the elevator stop and pick up passengers in the middle of a route, up or down? What should it do when it receives simultaneous requests? Under what conditions might it reverse direction without disgorging all its passengers? The program designers were Popperian creatures trying out hypotheses offline, but also Gregorian creatures using a suite of thinking tools to enhance their powers, no tool more potent than the programming language they chose to work in. The glory of a programming language is that once you get your design clearly written in the language of choice, Java or C++ or Python, say, you can count on the compiler program to take it from there, creating a file in machine language that can be executed. Computer programming is thus not so much top-down design as top-halfway-down design. The grubby details of the bottom of the design, the engine room if you like, is something you can ignore unless the program you are writing is a new compiler. There is nothing quite like this convenience to the designer in evolution by natural selection, but as Herbert Simon pointed out many years ago in his brilliant little book, The Sciences of the Artificial, complex evolvable systems, basically all living evolvable systems, depend on being organized hierarchically, composed of parts that have some stability independently of the larger system of which they are parts, and that are themselves composed of similarly stable parts composed of parts. A structure or a process need be designed only once and then used again and again, copied and copied not just between an organism and its offspring, but within an organism as it develops. As Richard Dawkins has observed, a gene is like a toolbox subroutine in a computer. The Mac has a toolbox of routines stored in ROM, read-only memory, or in system files permanently loaded at startup time. There are thousands of these toolbox routines, each one doing a particular operation which is likely to be needed over and over again in slightly different ways in different programs. For example, the toolbox routine called Obscure Cursor hides the cursor from the screen until the next time the mouse is moved. Unseen by you, the Obscure Cursor gene is called every time you start typing and the mouse cursor vanishes. This hierarchical systematicity is found throughout nature. It is in the genome and in the developmental processes that the genome directs. The vertebrae-making subroutine can be called a few more times, and we're on the way to making a snake. People with a sixth finger, a quite common mutation, have a hand-making subroutine that executed the finger-making subroutine one more time than usual. Once eyelid-making is a debugged program, it can be used with variations all over the animal world. So evolution by natural selection does have something a bit like source code, in having relatively simple instructions that trigger a cascade of further instructions to accomplish some modular task. But it is all in machine language, executed whenever it is called on. It doesn't need to be compiled, and there is no reader who needs a mnemonic crutch, call floor, weight in pounds, listen to Chapter 4, in order to understand it. The developing organism sorta understands the commands of its genes the way a von Neumann machine sorta understands its machine language instructions. It sorta obeys them. Competition and coalition in the brain. Evolution by natural selection is not top-down R&D, like computer programming, in spite of its invention and heavy use of modules. It is bottom-up R&D, Darwin's strange inversion. Brains, moreover, are not like digital computers in several ways. Three differences are most frequently cited, but are not, in my estimation, very important. 1. Brains are analog. Computers are digital. This is true, maybe, depending on what you mean by analog. If you mean not binary, using just 0 and 1, on and off, then probably brains are analog, but they may well prove to be digital in other ways. Any finite alphabet of signals with equivalence classes is a kind of digitizing, and as we will find out in the next chapter, this kind of digitizing is a very important feature of language. 2. Brains are parallel. They execute many millions of computations simultaneously, spread out over the whole fabric of the brain. Computers are serial. They execute one single simple command after another, a serial single-file stream of computations that makes up for its narrowness by its blinding speed. There are exceptions. Some special-purpose parallel architecture computers have been created, but the computers that are now embedded in everything from alarm clocks and toaster ovens to automobiles are all serial architecture von Neumann machines. You may well own 100 von Neumann machines hidden away inside your smart appliances and consigned to menial tasks that use a tiny fraction of their power. It is much cheaper to throw in a whole computer on a mass-produced chip than to design special-purpose hardware. It is true that the brain's architecture is massively parallel, with a vision system about a million channels wide, for instance, but many of the brain's most spectacular activities are roughly serial, in the so-called stream of consciousness, in which ideas or concepts or thoughts float by not quite in single file, but through a von Neumann bottleneck of sorts. You can simulate a virtual serial machine on a parallel architecture. That's what the brain does, as I showed in Consciousness Explained. And virtual parallel computers can be implemented on serial machines to any breadth you'd like, at a cost of operating speed. It is no accident that brains are massively parallel in their architecture, given the need for speed in controlling risky lives. But the moving parts of today's von Neumann machines have a basic cycle time billions of times faster than the response time of a neuron, so they have speed to burn. In recent years, artificial intelligence researchers have developed connectionist networks that loosely mimic neural networks in the brain, and they have proven to be very good at learning to discriminate things in images and other sorts of pattern recognition that our brains excel at. And they undoubtedly demonstrate the power of parallel processing, but in fact, the parallel processing done by these networks is almost all simulated on conventional serial von Neumann machines. Von Neumann machines are universal mimics that can simulate any other architecture. Today's speedy von Neumann machines, in spite of their severe bottlenecks, can pretend they are parallel processing neural networks so swiftly that they can keep up with, or surpass, the parallel processing brains that designed them. 3. Brains are carbon-based, protein, etc. Computers are silicon. This is true for the time being, though striking progress has been made by nanotechnologists intent on making computers out of proteins, and the protein networks inside cells do seem to be computing. And nobody has yet demonstrated that the difference in underlying chemistry gives an edge to carbon. How about this? 4. Brains are alive. Computers are not. Some would want to reply, and I used to reply, an artificial heart isn't alive, and it functions fine. A replacement hip or knee or shoulder doesn't have to be alive. You can replace or splice the auditory nerve with non-living wire, suitably attached at both ends. Why not the rest of the brain? Is there some super special piece of brain that must be alive for a brain to function? The standard working assumption of artificial intelligence has always been that any living organ is really just a very sophisticated bit of carbon-based machinery that can be replaced, piece by piece or all at once, by a non-living substitute that has the same input-output profile, does all and only the same things with the same inputs in the same time frame, without loss. If the brain were an organ for secreting bile or purifying the blood, the chemistry and physics of the working parts would matter greatly, and it might be impossible to find suitable substitutes for the materials used. But the brain is an information processor, and information is medium neutral. A warning or a declaration of love or a promise can be made out of anything, provided the recipient has the know-how to pick it up. But there is one feature of living things that might matter greatly in our quest to understand how minds work, and this has recently been illuminated by Terence Deacon in his difficult but important book, Incomplete Nature: How Mind Emerged from Matter. According to Deacon, the very moves I've been describing as brilliant strokes of simplification have pushed theory into the wrong regions of design space for half a century and more. Shannon's enabling stroke was to abstract the concept of information away from thermodynamics, away from the concept of energy and matter as noted above. Information is information, whether electrons or photons or smoke signals or magnetic regions or microscopic pits and plastic disks are involved. It takes energy to transmit and transform information. It isn't magic, after all. But we can isolate our understanding of the information processing from whatever energetic considerations are in play. Norbert Wiener created the field and the term cybernetics. He took the Greek verb for steer or govern, kybernou, from which the English word govern is also derived, and noted that while the controller of a ship, a city, a body, an oil refinery needs to use energy at some interface to push the rudder, utter the decree, turn up the temperature, the energy required to run the control system itself is ad lib, whatever you like, and not very much. It is this isolation of the computation from the dynamics of physical control that makes it possible to control almost anything today with your battery-powered smartphone, plus transducers and effectors of sufficient strength to do the hard work. There is a tiny drain on your smartphone battery when you use it remotely to send a radio signal to open your heavy garage door. The electric motor that is controlled by that weak signal draws considerable current in order to do its work. Deacon grants that this has permitted the blossoming of all the high-tech intelligent design we have been exploring. But he insists that by divorcing information processing from thermodynamics, we restrict our theories to basically parasitical systems, artifacts that depend on a user for their energy, for their structural maintenance, for their interpretation, and for their raison d'être. Living things, in contrast, are autonomous, and moreover, they are composed of living things, cells, that are themselves somewhat autonomous. Researchers in artificial intelligence could plausibly reply that they are postponing consideration of phenomena such as energy capture, reproduction, self-repair, and open-ended self-revision, expecting to reap the benefits of this simplification by first getting clear about the purely informational phenomena of learning and self-guidance, a kind of autonomy, however incomplete. Nobody would dream of complicating the design of a chess-playing computer by requiring it to obtain its energy from sandwiches and soft drinks, obliging it to monitor not only its time, but also its depleting reserves of usable energy. Human chess players have to control their hunger pangs and emotions, such as humiliation, fear, and boredom. But computers can finesse all that with impunity, can they not? Yes, but at a huge cost, says Deacon. By taking these concerns off their hands, system designers create architectures that are brittle. They can't repair themselves, for instance, vulnerable, locked into whatever set of contingencies their designers have anticipated, and utterly dependent on their handlers. This makes a big difference, Deacon insists. Does it? In some ways, I think it does. At the height of GOFAI back in the 1970s, I observed that AI programs were typically disembodied, bedridden aspirants to genius that could only communicate through reading and writing typed messages. Even work on computer vision was often accomplished with a single immovable video camera eye or by simply loading still images into the system the way you load pictures into your laptop, a vision system without any kind of eyes. An embodied mobile robot using sense organs to situate itself in its world would find some problems harder and other problems easier. In 1978, I wrote a short commentary entitled, "Why Not the Whole Iguana?" in which I argued for turning from truncated human micro-competences, answering questions about baseball, playing checkers, to attempting to model the computational architecture of a whole, self-protecting, energy-capturing robotic animal as rudimentary as you like. You have to get your simplicity somewhere. AI is hard. The animal could be imaginary, if that made the task easier. A three-wheeled Martian iguana, for instance. Some roboticists took up the challenge. For instance, Owen Holland started the Slugbot project, attempting to make a robot that would harvest slugs from grain fields and digest them to produce the electricity needed to power its computer chips, a project that has spawned other ingenious designs. That's energy capture. But what about self-repair and self-maintenance? Work on these and other requirements of life has proceeded for several decades, creating animats and nanobots that instantiate various hugely simplified versions of basic life processes. But nobody took the whole iguana idea as far as Deakin claims they should have. In their headquarters, these artificial creatures still relied on CPU chips, von Neumann hardware, even when they simulated parallel architectures. It is important, Deakin claims, that a brain be made of cells that are themselves autonomous little agents with agendas, chief of which is staying alive, which spawns further goals, such as finding work and finding allies. Deakin's insistence on making brains or brain substitutes out of living neurons might look at first like some sort of romanticism, protein chauvinism in effect, a fatal step or two away from vitalism. But his reasons are practical and compelling. We can illuminate Deakin's point with one phenomenon, the remarkable plasticity of the brain. If an area is damaged, a neighboring region can often, not always, take on the duties of the missing tissue swiftly and gracefully. If a region is underutilized, its neighbors soon recruit the cells there to help with their own projects. Neurons that are destroyed are not, in general, replaced the way skin cells and bone cells and blood cells, among others, are. Nerve regeneration is still mainly a dream of bioengineers, not a normal feature of nervous systems, so the plasticity observed in many experiments must be due to neurons being reassigned to new tasks or required to take on additional workloads. Is there a master personnel manager figuring out these new job descriptions and issuing commands from on high to the subservient neurons down on the shop floor? The computer scientist Eric Baum, in What is Thought, calls such arrangements Politburo control and notes that this top-down way to accomplish complex tasks is not the brain's way. Economists have shown why centrally planned economies don't work as well as market economies, and centrally planned, top-down architectures are ineffective brain organizers for much the same reasons. As roboticist Rodney Brooks has observed, personal communication, the hardware of existing digital computers depends critically on millions or billions of identical elements, perfect clones of each other almost down to the atomic level, so that they will always respond as they are supposed to respond, robotically. Engineers have managed to create the technology to print microscopic computer circuits with millions of identical flip-flops, each reliably storing a zero or one until ordered from on high to flip the bit. These are the ultimate moving parts of a computer, and they have no individuality, no idiosyncrasies at all. Neurons, in contrast, are all different. They come in a variety of quite clearly defined structural types, pyramidal, basket, spindle, and so on. But even within types, no two neurons are exactly alike. how can such a diverse population get organized to accomplish anything? Not by bureaucratic hierarchies, but by bottom-up coalition formation with lots of competition. Neurons, mules, and termites. Neurons, like all the rest of the cells that compose our bodies, are domesticated descendants of the free-living, single-celled eukaryotes that thrived on their own, fending for themselves as wildlife in a cruel world of unicellular organisms. François Jacob famously said that the dream of every cell is to become two cells, but neurons can't normally have offspring. Like mules, they have parents, well, a mother and a grandmother and so on, but are themselves sterile, so their summum bonum is just staying alive in their de-Darwinized niche. They have to work to capture the energy they need, and if they are not already fully employed, they will take on whatever odd jobs are available. Versions of this idea have recently blossomed in several different corners of cognitive science, and since they have persuaded me to jettison a position I had long defended, I want to emphasize my conversion. I've changed my mind about how to handle the homunculus temptation, the almost irresistible urge to install a little man in the brain to be the boss, the central meaner, the enjoyer of pleasures, and the sufferer of pains. In Brainstorms, I described and defended the classic GOFAI strategy that came to be known, thanks to Lycan, as homuncular functionalism, replacing the little man with a committee. The AI programmer begins with an intentionally characterized problem, and thus frankly views the computer anthropomorphically. If he solves the problem, he will say he has designed a computer that can, for instance, understand questions in English. His first and highest level of design breaks the computer down into subsystems, each of which is given intentionally characterized tasks. He composes a flowchart of evaluators, rememberers, discriminators, overseers, and the like. These are homunculi with a vengeance. Each homunculus in turn is analyzed into smaller homunculi, but more important, into less clever homunculi. When the level is reached where the homunculi are no more than adders and subtractors, by the time they need only the intelligence to pick the larger of two numbers when directed to, they have been reduced to functionaries who can be replaced by a machine. I still think this is on the right track, but I have come to regret and reject some of the connotations of two of the terms I used, committee and machine. The cooperative bureaucracy suggested by the former, with its clear reporting relationships, an image enhanced by the no-nonsense flowcharts of classical cognitive science models, captured the dream of top-down GOFAI, but it suggested a profoundly unbiological sort of efficiency. Turing's strange inversion of reasoning is still intact. Eventually, in our decompositional cascade, we arrive at elements whose tasks are so rigid and routinized that they can be replaced by a machine, just like Turing's diligent human computer. The simplest moving parts within neurons, the motor proteins and microtubules and the like, really are motiveless automata, like the marching broomsticks in The Sorcerer's Apprentice. But neurons themselves, in their billions, play more enterprising and idiosyncratic roles than the obedient clerks I was imagining them to be. And that fact has major implications for the computational architecture of brains. Tecumseh Fitch coined the term nano-intentionality to describe the agency exhibited in neurons, and Sebastian Sung gave a keynote address to the Society for Neuroscience on selfish neurons, and earlier wrote of hedonistic synapses. What could a neuron want? The energy and raw materials it needs to thrive, just like its unicellular eukaryote ancestors and more distant cousins, the bacteria and archaea. Neurons are sort of robots. They are certainly not conscious in any rich sense. Remember, they are eukaryotic cells, akin to yeast cells or fungi. If individual neurons are conscious, then so is athlete's foot. But neurons are, like yeast and fungi, highly competent agents in a life-or-death struggle, not in the environment between your toes, but in the demanding environment between your ears, where the victories go to those cells that can network more effectively, contributing to more influential trends at the levels where large-scale human purposes and urges are discernible. Turing, Shannon, and von Neumann, tackling a spectacularly difficult and novel engineering project, intelligently designed computers to keep needs and job performance almost entirely independent. Down in the hardware, the electric power is doled out even-handedly and abundantly. No circuit risks starving. At the software level, a benevolent scheduler doles out machine cycles to whatever process has highest priority. And although there may be a bidding mechanism of one sort or another that determines which processes get priority, this is an orderly queue, not a struggle for life. It is a dim appreciation of this fact that perhaps underlies the common folk intuition that a computer could never care about anything. Not because it is made out of the wrong materials. Why should silicon be any less suitable a substrate for caring than organic molecules? But because its internal economy has no built-in risks or opportunities, so its parts don't have to care. The top-down hierarchical architecture of computer software, supported by an operating system replete with schedulers and other traffic cops, nicely implements Marx's dictum, to each according to his needs, from each according to his talents. No adder circuit or flip-flop needs to worry about where it's going to get the electric power it needs to execute its duty, and there is no room for advancement. A neuron, in contrast, is always hungry for work. It reaches out exploratory dendritic branches, seeking to network with its neighbors in ways that will be beneficial to it. Neurons are thus capable of self-organizing into teams that can take over important information-handling work, ready and willing to be given new tasks which they master with a modicum of trial-and-error rehearsal. This is rather like the thousands of unemployed women who showed up at the gates of Oak Ridge to take on the tasks they didn't need to understand, but with a big difference. There is no General Leslie Groves to design the brain. It needs to be designed bottom-up. It is time to take stock of what these considerations imply. The top-down, intelligent design of the classic computer created a hyper-competent but deeply unbiological marvel. This is not because computers are made of the wrong kind of stuff, but because the stuff they are made of is organized into the wrong kind of hierarchies, the kind of planned bureaucracies that may be well-oiled machines but depend on regimentation of the moving parts, suppressing both exploration and improvisation at every level. It is important to stress again that, in principle, this conclusion leaves open the door for silicon-based, or Turing-based, whatever the physical medium, brains. Simulated or virtual neurons are possible in principle, but computationally very expensive. Each individual neuron would have to be modeled in all its idiosyncrasies, habits, preferences, weaknesses. To put the idea in perspective, imagine that intergalactic scientists discovered our planet and proceeded to study, from afar, the behavior of our cities and towns, our highways and railways and communication systems, as if these were organisms of some sort. Being enthusiastic developers of computer models, these scientists decide to make a simulation of New York City in all its activities. New Yorkabot, they call it. Go ahead and try, say the skeptics, but do realize that you will have to model all the millions of citizens, those squishy little moving things, in considerable detail if you want to have much hope of making a good predictive model. They are, none of them, exactly alike, and they are both curious and enterprising. Top-down intelligent designs depend on foresight, which evolution utterly lacks. The designs generated by natural selection are all, in a way, retrospective. This is what has worked in the past. Whether it will work in the future depends on whether the regularities on which the design is founded persist. Moth design could rely on the regularity of the sun and the moon being the only light sources in the environment, so fly at constant angle N to the light was a winning habit to hardwire into moths, until candle flames and electric light bulbs entered the scene. This is where too much regularity in the selective environment can be a trap, committing a lineage to a locked-in technique or disposition that can turn toxic when conditions change. As noted in Chapter 5, variable selective environments, precisely because of their unpredictability, favor the selection of incomplete designs, along with mechanisms to tune the design to suit the circumstances, exploitable plasticity, or, to use the everyday term, learning. Top-down, GOFAI-style systems can be equipped with tunable parameters and learning capabilities, of course, but the hierarchical control structure tends to commit to a fixed range of plasticity, based on a worst-case scenario estimate of what is likely to happen. Foresightless, backward-looking evolution by natural selection is not intelligent design, but still powerful R&D, sufficiently discerning so that the general division of labor in the brain can be laid down in the genetic recipes that have been accumulated and refined over the billion years or so of mobile life. And, as we have seen, the refinements and variations in the genes can set enough parameters to ensure that elaborate instinctive behaviors, such as nest building, can survive generation after generation. Fixing all the wiring details by genetic instruction would be impossible. It would require many times more bits of Shannon information than can be transmitted in a genome, even a 3 billion nucleotide long genome like ours. This is the undeniable message of Evo-Devo, evolutionary developmental biology, which stresses that the production of the next generation of any organism is not a straightforward matter of following a blueprint or recipe laid down in the genes. It is a construction job that must rely on local R&D that depends on the activity of myopic local agents that conduct more or less random trials as they interact with their surroundings in the course of development. Neurons, for instance, are akin to Skinnerian agents, taking their chances and making the most of the opportunities that come their way, exploiting their own plasticity to improve the performances for which they are rewarded or reinforced. Their efforts are, however, guided by some helpful landmarks laid down by the genes, giving them paths to follow. Brains are more like termite colonies than intelligently designed corporations or armies. How do brains pick up affordances? A recurring theme so far has been that all organisms, from bacteria to us, are designed to deal with a set of affordances, the things that matter, in a broad sense of thing, and that this catalog, an organism's Umwelt, is populated by two R&D processes, evolution by natural selection and individual learning of one sort or another. Gibson was notoriously silent on how organisms pick up the information needed to notice, identify, and track their affordances, and I have been postponing the question as well up to now. Here's what we have figured out about the predicament of the organism. It is floating in an ocean of differences, a scant few of which might make a difference to it. Having been born to a long lineage of successful copers, it comes pre-equipped with gear and biases for filtering out and refining the most valuable differences, separating the semantic information from the noise. In other words, it is prepared to cope in some regards. It has built-in expectations that have served its ancestors well, but may need revision at any time. To say it has these expectations is to say that it comes equipped with partially pre-designed appropriate responses all ready to fire. It doesn't have to waste precious time figuring out from first principles what to do about an A or a B or a C. These are familiar, already solved problems of relating input to output, perception to action. These responses to incoming stimulation of its sensory systems may be external behaviors. A nipple affords suckling, limbs afford moving, a painful collision affords retreating. Or they may be entirely covert internal responses, shaping up the neural armies into more effective teams for future tasks. How does this training happen? Here it will help to resurrect a somewhat discredited distinction from the early days of cognitive science: competence models versus performance models. A competence model, such as the grammar of a language, says how the system ought to work. It gives the specs, as in the elevator example of Chapter 4, while leaving the details of how to accomplish those requirements as a design problem with potentially many different solutions, different performance models. A performance model for implementing a grammar, for making a speaker of grammatical English, for instance, would be a job for neurolinguistics far in the future. In the early days of cognitive science, theoretical linguists argued over grammars without concerning themselves with how on earth a brain might follow the rule book. They just wanted to get the rule book right first. Meanwhile, psycholinguists devised clever experiments that showed patterns in grammatical errors that children made, sources of interference, failures of grammatical judgment, and the like, and when the theorists couldn't explain these patterns, they could handily excuse themselves, saying it was too early to try to account for grubby details of performance. People make mistakes. People have faulty memories. People jump to conclusions. But they still have the basic competence enshrined in their grammars, however sloppy their performance on this or that occasion. Performance models would come later. This was not always a useful division of labor, and it created a gulf in cognitive science that is still creating tension and miscommunication today. The linguists were right to insist that until you have a fairly clear idea of what a brain can and ought to do in the way of perceiving and uttering language, your efforts to reverse engineer the brain's language manipulating machinery are apt to be misguided, tackling misconceived problems. But part of the specs for any reverse engineering exploration has to be the limitations and strengths of the available machinery. And by postponing questions about the brain and underestimating the importance of the telltale performances elicited by the psycholinguists, the theoretical linguists conducted some wild goose chases of their own. With that caution in hand, we can address the idea that is now sweeping through cognitive science as a very promising answer to how the brain picks up and uses the available semantic information: Bayesian hierarchical predictive coding. The basic idea is delicious. The Reverend Thomas Bayes, 1701 to 1761, developed a method of calculating probabilities based on one's prior expectations. Each problem is couched thus: given that your expectations based on past experience, including, we may add, the experience of your ancestors as passed down to you, are such and such, expressed as probabilities for each alternative, what effect on your future expectations should the following new data have? What adjustments in your probabilities would it be rational for you to make? Bayesian statistics, then, is a normative discipline purportedly prescribing the right way to think about probabilities. So, it is a good candidate for a competence model of the brain. It works as an expectation-generating organ, creating new affordances on the fly. Consider the task of identifying handwritten symbols, letters, and digits. It is no accident that such a task is often used by internet sites as a test to distinguish real human beings from bots programmed to invade websites. Handwriting perception, like speech perception, has proven to be an easy task for humans, but an exceptionally challenging task for computers. Now, however, working computer models have been developed that can do a good job identifying handwritten, scribbled really, digits, involving a cascade of layers in which the higher layers make Bayesian predictions about what the next layer down in the system will see next. When the predictions prove false, they then generate error signals in response that lead to Bayesian revisions, which are then fed back down toward the input again and again until the system settles on an identification. Practice makes perfect, and over time, these systems get better and better at the job, the same way we do, only better. Hierarchical Bayesian predictive coding is a method for generating affordances galore. We expect solid objects to have backs that will come into view as we walk around them. We expect doors to open, stairs to afford climbing, and cups to hold liquid. These and all manner of other anticipations fall out of a network that doesn't sit passively waiting to be informed, but constantly makes probabilistic guesses about what it is about to receive in the way of input from the level below it, based on what it has just received, and then treating feedback about the errors in its guesses as the chief source of new information, as a way to adjust its prior expectations for the next round of guessing. Not least of the attractive properties of these applications of Bayesian thinking to the problem of how brains learn is that they provide a simple and natural explanation of an otherwise perplexing fact of neuroanatomy. In visual pathways, for instance, there are more downward than upward pathways, more outbound than incoming signals. On this view, the brain's strategy is continuously to create forward models, or probabilistic anticipations, and use the incoming signals to prune them for accuracy if needed. When the organism is on a roll in deeply familiar territory, the inbound corrections diminish to a trickle, and the brain's guesses, unchallenged, give it a head start on what to do next. These Bayesian models are descended from the analysis by synthesis models of early cognitive science, in which top-down curiosity, is it a deer? Is it a moose? Guide the formation of hypotheses for testing against the incoming data. Your brain analyzes the data by making a guess, synthesizing a version of what you're looking for, and matching it against the data. In Consciousness Explained, I offered a speculative model of dreams and hallucinations based on analysis by synthesis, arguing that the elaboration of content in these phenomena could be due to nothing more than a disordered or random or arbitrary round of confirmation and disconfirmation. This has been spectacularly supported and refined by recent work at Google Research. Today, I could simplify my account. In a Bayesian network, silence counts as confirmation. Whatever the higher levels guess counts as reality by default in the absence of disconfirmation. Another virtue of Bayesian models from our vantage point is that an organism can be blessed by natural selection with a high-powered statistical analysis engine without having to install a mathematician homunculus in a special office in the bureaucracy. These are, if you like, expectation-gathering fabrics with a remarkable competence they don't need to understand. In earlier work, I have warned against postulating wonder tissue in brains to do the hard work that has to be done somehow, without saying how the wonder tissue manages to be so splendid. These Bayesian fabrics are demonstrably not magic. They work just fine running on non-mysterious off-the-shelf computers. The details of neural implementation of such hierarchical predictive coding networks are still obscure, but they don't seem out of reach. This is all very well for animal cognition, and a number of the commentators on Clark's fine survey venture the tentative conclusion that animal minds are Bayesian expectation machines, relying on probabilities eked out of the passing show to guide all their behavior. But if so, then animal minds are, once again, termite colonies, not intelligent designers. They are so competent that we can concede them all kinds of behavioral comprehension, but still, in some important way yet to be articulated, they are missing one of our tricks, having reasons and not just acting for reasons. Bayesian anticipators don't need to express or represent the reasons they track. Like evolution itself, they blindly separate the informational wheat from the chaff and act on it. Reasons are not things in their ontologies, not salient items in their manifest images. But reasons are things for us. They are the very tools and objects of top-down intelligent design. Where do they come from? How do they get installed in our brains? They come, I am now at last ready to argue in some detail, via cultural evolution, a whole new process of R&D, less than a million years old, that designs, disseminates, and installs thinking tools by the thousands in our brains, and only our brains, turning them into minds. Not minds or sort of minds, but proper minds. Feral neurons? We're going to leave the level of neurons behind in subsequent chapters, but before we do, I can't resist a speculation that ties some of our themes together and might turn out to play a role in accounting for the fact that H. sapiens is, so far, the only species on Earth with proper minds, enculturated minds full of thinking tools. Neurons, I have claimed, are in effect the domesticated descendants of very ancient eukaryotes that faced life for eons as self-employed microorganisms. To distinguish such eukaryotes from bacteria and archaea, they are often called protists of the kingdom Protista. They managed well, of course, or we wouldn't be here. And the protists of today, such as amoebas and single-celled algae, still thrive thanks to their many and varied talents. When protists first began forming colonies, and eventually multi-celled organisms, they brought with them their genomes, instructions for all the competences they had acquired by natural selection over billions of generations. Many of these talents were no longer needed in their new sheltered neighborhoods, so they were lost, or at least these expressions of the relevant genes were lost, since they no longer paid for themselves. But it proves to be cheaper and quicker to leave the genes alone and turn off some of their expression and development than to erase genes altogether. Over time, they will erase themselves if never used. This is nicely parallel to a tactic in software development, legacy code. When software is revised, as it often is, I am writing this book in Word 14.4.8, which wears its genealogy on its sleeve, being the 8th minor revision of the 4th major revision of the 14th new and improved version. The programmers would be foolish to discard all the hard work of earlier generations of programmers. Who knows when you might need it for something? So they have the practice of leaving obsolete code intact right beside the code that replaces it but just commented out. Enclosing the legacy code in brackets or asterisks or some other convention recognized by the compiler program guarantees that it will be passed over by the compiler and hence not represented in the code to be executed by the computer. Remember that there is no source code compiled code distinction in genomes, but the same silencing of code can occur thanks to a simple mutation in a regulatory gene, a gene for controlling the expression of genes for proteins. When animals are domesticated, their domesticators select, either unconsciously or methodically, desirable traits. The differences in a litter or herd that are large and visible are likely to be the result of relatively minor genetic differences, and these may be differences in the expression of a gene shared by all. The domesticators need not have any understanding of or intention to produce the effects they are having on the genes of their livestock, but silencing genes while leaving them unchanged is a likely path to the desired results. Then, when descendants of the domesticated animals escape and go feral, all that has to happen genetically to restore the wild characteristics that have been suppressed is the removal of the brackets that enclose the legacy code, which then springs back into action. This may well explain the strikingly quick reversion to wild traits that occurs in feral lineages. In a few generations, feral pigs, for instance, will recover many traits of their wild boar relatives, in both appearance and behavior, and feral horses, called Mustangs in the United States, are only a few hundred years away from their domesticated forebears, but differ significantly in disposition. Your average neuron is apparently docile enough to spend its long lifetime doing the same job while still maintaining a spark of autonomy, a modest ability and disposition to try to improve its circumstances when opportunity knocks. We can easily imagine that some environments in which neurons find themselves favor more enterprising, risky exploration of options, breeding more versatile, aggressive neurons. In such conditions, selection could favor the renewed expression of long-silenced genes, at least in some subpopulations of neurons in critical regions of the brain. There would be feral neurons, in effect, a bit less stable, more selfish, a bit more likely to morph themselves into novel connections with neighbors. What sort of condition might favor this trend? How about the arrival of invaders? New kinds of entities need local supporters to further their own replication and help them compete against each other for hegemony in the brain. What do invading armies do when attempting to assert control over newly occupied territory? They open the prisons, releasing the prisoners in order to staff security forces with hardened natives who know their way around. This oft-reinvented good idea could be the free-floating rationale of a parallel development in brains. We are about to embark on a detailed account and defense of memes, informational viruses that govern infectious habits. When they spread through a population, they need neural resources to replicate in much the way viruses need to commandeer the copy machinery in individual cells to get new copies of themselves made. Viruses obviously can't understand the rationale for their quest. It is just their nature to have this effect on cells they encounter. They are macromolecules, after all, not even living things. And memes, as viruses of the mind, made of nothing but information, have to get into minds, and then have to get rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed. But they don't need to comprehend this or anything else. This strange idea of mindless informational things that provoke coalitions of rebellious neurons to support them, the idea of memes infecting brains, will take several chapters to articulate and defend. Here, I am pointing out that if anything like that invasion happened, it would no doubt involve a coevolutionary process in which human brains, the only brains so far seriously infected with memes, were selected for handling memes, sheltering them and aiding in their reproduction in much the way fig trees have co-evolved with the parasitic wasps who return the favor by helping pollinate the fig trees. Neurons come in different shapes and sizes, and one kind, the von Economo neuron, or spindle cell, is found only in animals with very large brains and complex social lives. Humans and other great apes, elephants, and cetaceans, whales and dolphins. Since the many other species that share common ancestors with these lineages lack von Economo cells, these neurons have apparently evolved quite recently and independently, convergent evolution, to play similar roles. Perhaps they are just long-distance communicators in those large brains, but they also tend to be concentrated in brain areas known to be involved in self-monitoring, decision-making, and social interaction, to put it very generally. The possibility that their presence in these different highly social lineages is no coincidence suggests that they are likely candidates for further exploitation by meme invaders. But we may discover others once we have a better idea what to look for. We have set the stage for the invasion. Brains are computers, but they are very unlike the computers in use today. Composed of billions of idiosyncratic neurons that evolved to fend for themselves, the brain's functional architecture is more like a free market than a Politburo hierarchy where all tasks are assigned from on high. The fundamental architecture of animal brains, including human brains, is probably composed of Bayesian networks that are highly competent expectation generators that don't have to comprehend what they are doing. Comprehension, our kind of comprehension, is only made possible by the arrival on the scene quite recently of a new kind of evolutionary replicator, culturally transmitted informational entities, memes.